How's the reading going?
Did anyone decide they wanted to just spend spring break reading all of Aurora Leigh? Was that your... so you sort of decided that?
At least for the first essay.
Well, okay, you could do it. It's long.
Oh, no.
But did you read a plot summary? I know that you...
I read a plot summary of book one.
Oh, okay, of book one. Lots of wild and melodramatic things happen in Aurora Leigh, which will either make you think, wow, I really want to read that, if you were to go to Wikipedia and read a plot summary. I mean, it's not hard to find a plot summary of Aurora Leigh. Or you might decide, wait a second, that's pretty melodramatic. There's a lot of melodrama, but what you have to, part of what the melodrama is about is, sorry, let me just, part of what the melodrama is about is the kind of stuff that was going on in Victorian England that wasn't discussed in proper circles. So what happens is Romney gets involved with a single mother who has been raped, which is how she gets pregnant. And there's all sorts of real and serious social issues are discussed in the poem. And as I was saying on Monday, one of the questions is, to what extent is poetry still relevant in a world where the argument is these are the things that have to be discussed? This is the real world. This is what's happening. It's a world of crime and oppression and poverty and all the things that go with it. And poetry is looking like something irrelevant. And part of what EBB, as she often just used those three letters to signify herself. And what that meant was that when she married Robert Browning, she could still use the same three letters. Part of the feminism of the poem is the her embracing, both Aurora and EBB, embracing the idea that poetry has become a woman's domain in the 19th century. That is, that what men are saying is, we're doing serious stuff, we're doing science, we're doing STEM, by which they don't mean Shakespeare, Tolstoy, Emerson, and Montaigne. They don't actually use the term STEM, obviously. That's a 21st century term. But we're doing things that really matter. And we are doing social criticism and understanding what the social world is really like. And yeah, it's fine for women to do their little womeny poetry thing. And what EBB is saying is, yes, if you... are still committed to poetry, as you really should be, then you are also committed to feminism and to feminist interventions in this world in which men are trying to say that only men are important. And so there's a kind of double claim, a double political move or perspective or demand that she's making, which is feminism equals poetry. Poetry equals feminism. Pushing for poetry is pushing for feminism and pushing for the insights and the analyses that feminism is offering. And pushing for feminism would mean pushing for poetry. That is, pushing for a mode that is capable of such insights, such analyses. So there's something really strong about, and the opposite of anachronistic, the opposite of a kind of ineffectual elitism that EBB is pushing for in pushing for poetry and pushing for feminism. When she was a young girl, she read Mary Wollstonecraft's Vindication of the Rights of Women. Do people know what that book is? Yeah. What is it? Graduate students. Oh, grad students. What is it?
It kind of is what it's described as. I mean, where Mary Wollstonecraft was writing kind of some early feminist, you know, ideas. Just trying to make an argument for them.
But it's also not the same idea as, you know, the contemporary sense of feminism, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It's coming from an angle that, you know, women need to be educated so, you know, they... I don't know, maybe this is not the best way to put it, but they can be, you know, in this case, they can be more fitting as men's companions, something like that.
I think that's putting it down too much.
I think it was just that she was trying to make an argument that women were capable of more than they were being given credit for, and that they needed to, like, lean into that, but also be given the opportunity to lean into that.
Yeah, okay, so it might seem now to you that compared to contemporary feminism, it's not making that strong an argument, but compared to what people were thinking then, it was a revolutionary book. It's where, it in a way, it's the origin of feminism over the last 225 years or so. That is the idea of women's rights. I mean, just think of the title, A Vindication of the Rights of Women. That is something that starts there. And the claim that the demands that she's making in that book were really radical for the time, felt to be really radical. She was married to William Godwin. Yeah, Quinn.
Sorry. No, it's just a question about, like, how these particular fires of feminism were lit at this time, as opposed to, like, 50 or 100 years before. Like, what were the precedents?
So it's partly the French Revolution. That is that it is an age of revolution. So the precedent for revolution is actually the English Revolution of 1642, which is what Milton is involved with as a revolutionary. And that ended with the beheading of King Charles. And we're now up to our third Charles, but that was the first one. And the eventual restoration, the revolution eventually more or less failed, but kind of didn't. But that revolution was a century later, a little over a century later, the inspiration for the American Revolution, and not the 1619 project version of the American Revolution, but the Declaration of Independence, Inalienable Rights version of the American Revolution, and also and explicitly of the French Revolution in 1789. So that was a revolutionary age. It's sometimes called the Age of Revolutions, which goes from 1789 to 1848, first of all. But then that leads not too long after that to the Russian Revolution. Revolutions against authority were beginning to spread everywhere. In 1789, there's the Haitian Revolution, which is one of the three great revolutions of the time, the American, the French, and the Haitian Revolution. That is starting to spread everywhere. And Godwin was part of that movement, and married to Mary Wollstonecraft, also part of that movement, who made the Declaration of the Rights of Man, as the French Revolution puts it, into also the rights of women, hence the Vindication of the Rights of Women. She died in childbirth, giving birth to, anyone know? Anyone else know? Any undergrads know? Yeah.
Mary Shelley.
Yes, Mary Shelley, famous for writing, among other things, famous for writing Frankenstein. And a really interesting thing, I'll just say this parenthetically about Frankenstein, is that the monster in Frankenstein, or the creature, Frankenstein, you all know, is the creator, right? Is the human being who has studied a lot of STEM and thinks, yeah, why not create an AI that can answer any questions, more or less. But the creature learns to speak, it's actually French, but we forget that very, very soon. One of the ways the creature learns to speak and to read and therefore to interact with Victor Frankenstein, his creator, not Dr. Frankenstein, by the way, he doesn't have a PhD, just saying. Mm-hmm. He's a student, a grad student, really. By spying on and overhearing someone teaching someone else to read Paradise Lost. So for him, Paradise Lost is one of the formative books in his life. And Satan, who is the revolutionary in Paradise Lost, for those who don't know it, Paradise Lost is a mythological version of the English Revolution that Milton was involved in. He retells the story, but instead of being a war in England, it becomes a war in heaven. And the king, who has to be overthrown because he's such a tyrant, is, remember I quoted that limerick by Dante Gabriel Rossetti for you, there is a creator named God. So the cruel tyrant, the king, is God in Paradise Lost, but he's standing for King Charles, who also thought he was God. He said, I'm the representative of God on earth. And so Milton said, fine, here's what's wrong with God. So this is one reading of Paradise Lost. Not quite my reading, but close to my reading. And it was Mary Shelley's reading and her husband Percy Shelley's reading of Paradise Lost, that Satan is the hero of Paradise Lost. So all of those things, yeah, they're kind of originating in the English Revolution, but they are really catching fire at the end of the 18th century, in the last 25 years of the 18th century. And Mary Wollstonecraft was the mother of Mary Shelley, was the pretty much the spark that sparked a feminist the feminist mode of this revolution, which is still going on and which is still not over. I mean, there's a famous story about Cho En Lai. Do people know who Cho En Lai was?
The Chinese Revolution?
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. The friend or competitor of Mao's. So he was asked in like 1972 or so, did he think the French Revolution was a good thing? Did he think, because the argument is, yeah, it's a bourgeois revolution. It just leads to contemporary bourgeois, the contemporary bourgeois Western capitalist oppressive world. It's not really revolutionary. And other people say, no, it's the beginning of the revolutions that lead to the possibility of human liberation everywhere. And so Cho was asked, what did he think of the French Revolution? Was it a good idea? And he said, so this is almost 200 years later, famous line, too early to tell. But the idea then is that these revolutionary dominoes that are falling, they're still falling. It's not like, okay, this is 200-year-old history. It's not. This is the origin of a feminist movement that is, you know, turning one way that it's manifesting itself now is LGBTQ+ movements. And it's really, if there's one person, and there never is, but if there's one person you can ascribe it to, it's Mary Wollstonecraft. And if there's one domino that's really important early on, at least in England, it's EBB. Not the most important, but important. And the argument that she's making in a poem like Aurora Leigh is that a commitment to feminism is a commitment to seeing the world as radical poets see it, and a commitment to radical poetry, which is, you know, which is almost synonymous with great poetry, because for poetry to be great, it has to be radically new. It has to make you see things you might not otherwise have seen. At least that's the romantic theory. A commitment to great poetry is a commitment to being radical. And for her, being radical means being feminist, as being feminist means being radical. So those are things to keep in mind, and that's the issue in Aurora Leigh. And basically it's saying you are not being fully radical if you are only concerned with political economy. If you are dismissing the idea of literature, the idea of poetry, as not part of radical human thought. And in this case, radical human thought means feminist thought. And that is what the argument between Romney and Aurora is. And then just to give you a kind of parenthetical thing to say about the personal aspects of this, which we talked about a little bit before. So when she eloped with Robert Browning, her father never forgave her. One issue for Elizabeth Barrett was that her father and her family were involved in not the slave trade itself in Jamaica, but they made money off of slavery. That is the family's economic history. People say this about Jane Austen, and it's probably not fair to Jane Austen because her family was too separated from the slave trade and they were actually, her brother was a really strong abolitionist, but she wasn't in any way supported by slavery. But the Barretts were. The fact of slavery is how they made their money, and the abolition of slavery made their lives economically hard. So that was something that she felt guilt about and anger about throughout her life. And she wrote a lot of anti-slavery poetry, and if this were a class in her, we would be reading that. And one of her admirers was Frederick Douglass, who loved her anti-slavery poetry. So this is a thing to know about her own politics, the origin and the content of her politics. So, you know, this is just contextualizing moments in the poem. And then, as I say, Romney Leigh and Aurora Leigh, they have the same last name because they're cousins. Eventually they get married, but, so that's a spoiler, but it's not that big a spoiler, actually. That's not in any way the important thing that happens in Aurora Leigh. But they still have the same last name, so she doesn't have to change her name to marry him. But the idea of being married to someone who is also really good at what he does, which is different from what you do, and sharing a last name with that guy, so that's EBB and Robert Browning. So at the time when people talked about Browning, well, yeah, they would say Mrs. Browning because it was the 19th century. But the first poet that you would think of if someone said the poet Browning in, let's say, the 1850s, was her rather than him. And he thought that was right. He totally agreed with that. That's just a thing to know about how the personal is political, how the political is personal. And her break with her father was a powerful refusal not to go with one guy over another. It wasn't, okay, you're a woman, so you get to pick the guy who dominates you. Isn't that great? But rather, no, to marry for love, to marry someone who devoted himself to her as he did, and to marry as an equal, and which she definitely was with Robert Browning. I mean, there's no question in her mind. Yeah.
Were there people in their community that were sort of like on this opposing societal side with her father, or were they just part of this radical poetic community that loved this equal marriage?
So what do you mean? Sorry, what's the distinction? You mean people just who were...
Were there like a lot of, I guess, variations in how people interacted in society? Like Elizabeth Barrett Browning's father hated that she eloped with this man that
yeah.
had this... Were there people in their like literary community that felt the same way about them, or was
as her father? You mean?
Yeah.
Not that I know of.
It was just a radical community that kind of all wanted to build on this
idea. Well, so maybe what you could say is that the poets that they knew, and they knew a lot of poets, some liked her and some liked him and some disliked her and some disliked him, but the poets that they knew in the Victorian era, you know, with some exceptions, but they were feeling the way Aurora Leigh is describing the time is it's not an age for poetry. Poetry is over. And so the poets were... mostly, you could say that was just, they weren't happy about that. And so the defense of poetry, again, the great, so just because this is going to come up, I wasn't planning to talk about all this context, but it is going to come up. Shelley had a friend named Thomas Love Peacock. Peacock's wonderful. He was a poet and a novelist and an essayist, and he was older than Shelley, but Shelley supported him for a while, and then he lived up until the middle of the 19th century. Shelley died at the age of 29, 201 years ago in 1822. Peacock wrote a famous essay called The Four Ages of Poetry, in which he basically said, poetry is now over. And Shelley's response to that was his great essay, which if you take a Shelley course, you would definitely read, called?
A Defense of Poetry.
A Defense of Poetry. And Shelley was... this is Percy Shelley, was the most radical, with the possible exception of William Blake, the most radical of Romantic poets. And Karl Marx said of Shelley and Byron, because they were besties, Byron, after Shelley drowned, said, "Shelley was the only man I ever knew who wasn't a brute." Byron was very radical too. He died fighting for Greek independence, and he had all sorts of radical ideas, but he was 36 when he died. And Marx said, yeah, but he was turning bourgeois at the end. And Marx said, every true revolutionary weeps at the death of Shelley, because he would always have been radical, but is grateful that Byron died when he did before he had a chance to become conservative. So Shelley was Marx's favorite English poet, with the possible exception of Milton, but Marx explicitly talked about Shelley's radicalness. So he wrote this defense of poetry, in which he says poetry is the most radical thing there is. And he says, of course you have to do political economy. I plan to write essays, because he thought about these things deeply, which analyze the economy scientifically, analyze politics scientifically also. But you also need poetry to be radical. So he talks about the Hero of Paradise Lost there. That's one of several places where he talks about the Hero of Paradise Lost, which in an offhanded way, assuming that everyone will know he means Satan, which people wouldn't have known until that time. But he has the famous stirring last line that, do you remember? Last sentence of the Defense of Poetry? Anyone?
The poets are the unregistered legislators of the world.
Unacknowledged legislators of the world. So that poets are the ones who actually inspire radical insight and radical action and radical optimism. Gramsci has a famous phrase you probably know, pessimism of the intellect, optimism of the will, a famous 20th century phrase. And it's Shelley who was all for optimism of the will, that is, be a revolutionary. So he was writing in response to Peacock, whose daughter is going to appear later on in this course. So just again to make some affiliations here. But the idea is that if you're a poet, you might have a not exactly accurate, but nevertheless received attitude towards love poetry before the Age of Revolutions, which is women are to be loved. You know, you just fall in love with a woman because she's kind and sweet and gentle and good looking and understands how deep you are. So that's a parody, but it's a parody that a lot of 19th century poets thought was true, or thought was more or less true. And what's happening now in the Victorian era is that it's a lot harder to, it's also tempting for a lot of Victorian poets, but it's also a lot harder to take that view of women. And it's partly because of people like EBB, and not only her, mainly her, because she was so influential and so important. But that idea is it's women are poets now too, and they are as good as the male poets. And it was very rare before this era that the idea that the greatest English poet of the time might be a woman was conceivable to the culture at large. And it is in the Victorian era that it does become conceivable to the culture at large. But the result of that, you could say, again, this is to simplify a bit, but the result of that is there's a backlash against poetry. Oh, okay, so the greatest poets are women? Just shows that poetry isn't really relevant to the present day. Men are doing stuff that's more important. It's that backlash, you could say, that is behind Aurora Leigh, behind her defense of poetry, because you could call this poem a defense of poetry as well. That is behind her defense of poetry, behind EBB's defense of poetry, and that is part of a more general defense of poetry, sometimes explicitly feminist, sometimes not, but which is saying something like to do what really matters in making the world a juster place, rather than excluding poetry, poetry should be part of that movement. And, we'll be spending next week and some of today on Robert Browning, But as I say, Robert Browning agreed with her on this. One of the arguments that, or one of the ways this comes out, I'll just tell you this, is not the, it, by no no means the most important way, but the three great Greek dramatists, tragedians, are who? Anyone know? Guy who wrote Oedipus? Okay. Guy who wrote the Oresteia? Aeschylus. Right. And the guy who wrote Medea and Phaedra and tons of other plays that survive? Aristophanes was the comic.
Yeah, there's a comic guy. Starts with an E.
Yeah, Euripides. Yeah. There's a famous, often parodied because there's unfortunately a really bad word in it, but a famous set of lines by EBB where she talks about how much she likes Euripides. She describes, are Euripides the human with his droppings of warm tears? So the word droppings is unfortunate there. But it's partly unfortunate because it means something different now from what it meant then. But she loves Euripides. Of the three, it's generally, Aeschylus is generally considered the greatest, but she loves Euripides the most. And in one of Robert Browning's late poems, a poem, called Blaustian's Last Adventure, which is part of a longer thing on the adventures of Blaustian. So Blaustian is a female narrator of this very, very long and almost entirely unread poem. Part of it is called Aristophanes' Apology. This is after EBB has died. And it's a debate between Blaustian and Aristophanes, the comic poet who made fun of all the serious Greeks of his era, who were friends of his, but he made fun of them. He made fun of Socrates. He made fun of Aeschylus and Sophocles and Euripides. And it's a debate about Euripides versus Aeschylus. And at one point, Aristophanes, who's been pushing for Aeschylus all the way through, has to admit that there's something that, and Blaustian, who, as I say, is a female narrator of this, and whose name means pomegranate. So she's an invented character, and there's maybe a sense of Persephone and the pomegranate seed in the fact that Browning decided to give her that name. Is pushing for Euripides, and at some point, so here let me distribute this to you, Aristophanes kind of accepts that there's something right about that. And the basic question is poetry human or is poetry supernatural? Does it come from the realm of the gods and therefore is something that we should worship and think of as essentially, you could say, hugely conservative because hugely received from divine authority. So should we think of poetry that way, or should we think of our Euripides, thank you, our Euripides the human? And part of what's going on among the Brownings and among a whole lot of these poets is to say, no, poetry is human thought as well. And if women are writing poetry, well, guess what? Women are humans. That is something that gets conceded here. Before we look at this, there are a couple of, and then we will look at this as a kind of introduction to Robert Browning. But let's just look at one, we'll just do this quickly, at one kind of parodic moment in Aurora Leigh, which is when she goes to see, she goes to England. She can't believe how boring it is after Florence. I should tell you that after she died, Robert Browning never went back to Florence where they'd been living. He just couldn't stand to go back. But after Florence, here she is in England. This is page 108, let's say around line 251. And the universe had turned stranger for a child because her father has just died as well. I just want to point one really nice little moment out earlier, by the way. If you go, look at the bottom page 105, she's thinking of her mother, a dauntless muse who eyes a dreadful fate, a loving Psyche who loses sight of love, a still Medusa with mild milky brows, all curdled and all clothed upon with snakes whose slime falls fast as sweat will. Or anon Our Lady of the Passion, stabbed with swords where the babe sucked. Or Lamia in her first moonlighted pallor. Who wrote a poem about Lamia, grad students, do you know? Keats. She is thinking of Keats's poem called Lamia. Ere she shrunk and blinked and shuddering wrinkled down to the unclean. Or my own mother, leaving her last smile in her last kiss upon the baby mouth my father pushed down on the bed for that. Or my dead mother, without smile or kiss, buried at Florence. So my own mother leaving her last smile and her last kiss upon the baby mouth my father pushed down on the bed for that. So her mother is dying, and her father takes her to her mother's bed and puts her on the mattress and pushes her down because her mother can't lift her head up so that she can get this last kiss. And then she dies. So it's just a really it's just a light touch, but a really moving moment. Okay, so now she gets to England, and how can this be the place that people talk about? Did Shakespeare and his mates, this is line 267, did Shakespeare and his mates absorb the light here? Not a hill or stone with heart to strike a radiant color up or active outline on the indifferent air. So what a boring place England is. And then there's her aunt. I think I see my father's sister stand upon the hall step of her country house to give me welcome. And what's she like? Well, she stood straight and calm, her somewhat narrow forehead braided tight as if for taming accidental thoughts from possible pulses. So a figure of self-repression. She's dressed in such a way as though her hair is going to prevent her thoughts from thinking anything radical, anything interesting, anything original. Brown hair pricked with gray by frigid use of life. She was not old, although my father's elder by a year, a nose drawn sharply yet in delicate lines, a close, mild mouth, a little soured about the ends, though through speaking unrequited loves or peradventure niggardly half-truths. Eyes of no color, once they might have smiled, but never, never have forgot themselves in smiling. Cheeks, in which was yet a rose of perished summers, like a rose in a book, kept more for ruth than pleasure, if past bloom, past fading also. So she's a repressive figure, but she's repressing herself. In other words, this is about, you could call it the reproduction of repression. That is, yeah, she did feel love, maybe once. She spoke unrequited loves, or she spoke half-truths, but unwillingly. And her eyes once might have smiled. They're not smiling now, but they once might have smiled. But they couldn't forget themselves. There was a rose of Parrish Summers, but now it's dried out. It's still there, but it's like a pressed rose in a book. She had lived, we'll say, a harmless life. She called a virtuous life. So Aurora doesn't think harmless and virtuous are the same thing. She called a virtuous life a quiet life, which was not life at all. But that she had not lived enough to know. So she didn't even know that she wasn't living a real life. Between the vicar and the county squires, the Lord Lieutenant looking down sometimes from the Empyrean to assure their souls against chance vulgarisms. And in the abyss, the apothecary looked on once a year to prove their soundness of humility. So she lives in a place where the vicar approves of her if she follows religion and follows his account of religion. And the apothecary, you know, let's just say if she needs medicine because she might not be behaving the way she's supposed to. And then, but she does good things. The poor club exercised her Christian gifts of knitting stockings, stitching petticoats. Because we are of one flesh, after all, and need one flannel with a proper sense of difference in the quality. So, you know, she's doing charitable things. She is knitting stockings. She's stitching petticoats because we're all humans. We are of one flesh, after all, and need one flannel. We all need to be clothed, but then parentheses, with a proper sense of difference in the quality. So the poor certainly shouldn't think that they should get fancy clothes. So this is not a sympathetic portrait, but it's not unsympathetic. It's a portrait of someone who's been ruined by the oppressive ideology of the church, let's say, and of the society and culture. And she's doing what she's supposed to be doing, but not more than what she's supposed to be doing. And then this, and still the book club, guarded from your modern trick of shaking dangerous questions from the crease, preserved her intellectual. So she belongs to a book club and they're reading, but even there, so everyone can read, literacy is a good thing, but even there, she is prevented, they are prevented from getting anything radical about the book, from the books that they're reading. The book club is guarded from the idea that dangerous questions might arise in books. So she had lived a sort of cage bird life, born in a cage, accounting that to leap from perch to perch was act and joy enough for any bird. Dear heaven, how silly are the things that live in thickets and eat berries. So birdcage, much better. So very bourgeois. I, alas, a wild bird scarcely fledged was brought to her cage, and she was there to meet me. Very kind. Bring the clean water. Give out the fresh seed. So that is the crude, materially okay life that is the opposite of what poetry is seeking or demanding. So Aurora Leigh is standing for, in this metaphor, the wildness of the birds rather than the tamed birds in the cage. So that, I think, is a way of describing the commitments of the poem towards poetry and towards feminism, and saying those commitments are synonymous with each other, and that the very fact that you can see poetry on the downswing is showing what's wrong with contemporary culture and contemporary society. So the feminism and the literary ambition of Aurora Leigh, it's not that they are in sync with each other. They are the same thing. literary ambition where you're trying to do something radical, being a feminist where you're trying to do something radical, they are the same thing for EBB and for Aurora Leigh. Were you about to say something?
No.
Oh, I thought I saw your hand go up. Okay.
I think it's funny that, you know, we're talking about, this is, the passage, especially with the birds, makes me think of another parallel with Jane Eyre, that very famous passage about, you know, I have no bird, no net ensnares me.
Yeah, nice.
I just thought it was funny.
Yes, so there's Jane Eyre again.
Yeah, important.
Yeah, good. Yeah, great. And I should just tell you that Emily Dickinson, I think I mentioned this before, but really liked Emily Bronte and really liked EBB. And they were really, really important to her. And for the right reasons, she was the most perceptive of readers in the world, Dickinson was. And some of her imagery, actually, she picks up from and plays with from Aurora Leigh and some of Dickinson's poems as well. Okay, just a couple of other things to say. So if you go to page 102, there's one poem from the book called Sonnets from the Portuguese. So is that a familiar title to people, Sonnets from the Portuguese? The most famous sonnet from the Portuguese, which Ricks didn't put in this anthology because he kind of didn't need it, maybe, is, anyone know? How do I love thee? Let me count the ways. Is that familiar to people?
Yeah.
Yeah, so that's one of the sonnets from the Portuguese. And here's the one that he does put in, and it's a good one. Let the world's sharpness, like a clasping knife, shut in upon itself and do no harm in this close hand of love, now soft and warm, and let us hear no sound of human strife after the click of the shutting. So the world is sharp, like a pen knife, a foldable knife, but now it should be in the warm hand, and the knife should be shut. Life to life, I lean upon thee, dear, without alarm, and feel as safe, as guarded by a charm against the stab of worldlings, who, if rife, are weak to injure. So the image of the knife not cutting, of it being made safe, of not being stabbed by the world, that's the image that she's pursuing through this. Very whitely still, the lilies of our lives may reassure their blossoms from their roots, accessible alone to heavenly dews that drop not fewer, growing straight out of man's reach on the hill. God only, who made us rich, can make us poor. So, Quinn, is your hand up? Or no? Okay.
No, I can talk about it.
Okay, go. Talk.
I mean, that's actually the last line is what I highlighted. So, you know, God only can take your life away.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, God made us rich, and he's the only one who can do anything to us. Everything else is in our control. It's not in control of anyone else, including my father. It's not in the control of anyone else in the world. The world may want to stab us, but we can close this knife. Notice that it's a sonnet. Yeah. Oh.
No, sorry. Just,
it's okay. It's a sonnet. It's what's called a Petrarchan sonnet. That is, just to notice the rhyme scheme, it's A-B-B-A, A-B-B-A again. We talked a little bit about those interlocking rhymes when we were looking at the Spenserian stanzas at the beginning of... what, Tennyson poem? No, the Lotus Eaters. Those are the stanzas that are rhymed A, B, A, B, B, C, B, C, C. So interlocking rhymes. But this is a standard sonnet form called the Petrarchan sonnet. So you can see that the first eight lines have a very regular rhyme scheme. Then in Petrarch and Sonnets, you'll get in the last six lines, there are lots of different possible rhyme schemes. Here it's still, accessible, reassure, fewer, hill, poor. So still, accessible, hill. So that would be C. Reassure is D, accessible is C, fewer is D, hill is C, poor is D. So C, D, C, D, C, D for the last six. Yeah.
No, just a technical issue. Does still and accessible actually rhyme?
For the purposes of the sonnet, they do. Okay. No, it's part of the history. It's been years since... people have been interested enough for me to teach this course, but I used to teach a graduate seminar on versification in English poetry, the whole history of versification. And one of the interesting things about it is that there are empirical differences in what counts as meter and what counts as rhyme down the generations. So if you think, what a mortal hand or eye could frame thy fearful symmetry, do those rhyme? Yeah, they do. But not for us, and probably not for Blake, if you were simply saying, can you hear the difference between eye and symmetry? He would have. But they count as rhyming because they got accepted as part of the language, because in Shakespeare's day, they did rhyme. You would say, what immortal hand or E could frame thy fearful symmetry, and then that got accepted as a rhyme. So the history of poetic form is partly a history of the language changing, but things still counting as rhymes because they were well known enough to be accepted as rhymes. So accessible and hill, not for Shakespeare, but in the 19th century, yes. So good question. Okay, just to tell you the sonnets from the Portuguese, she wrote these when she was in love with Robert Browning, when they were courting, didn't tell him she was writing them. But after they got married, she showed them to him. He didn't know them. And his their pet name for her was, she was the Portuguese. So sonnets from the Portuguese, everyone thinks means sonnets translated from the Portuguese. They're not. They are the sonnets that this woman who called herself the Portuguese in their marriage, that was their pet name, wrote to him. So this isn't explained when the book is published, and they were perfectly happy for people to think they were translations. But that is the secret meaning of the title of the book. The Portuguese is her. Sorry?
She doesn't know Portuguese, right?
No. But she did know Greek and Latin. She learned Greek and Latin at the age of 10. So that is something to know about her, is that she was really, really, really well educated. She was the eldest of 12 children. And her father, before he became the crazy jerk that he became, some of the portrait of Aurora Leigh's father is accurate to her own father, and some isn't. And his devotion to his children when they were young is accurate, and his desire to have them well educated is accurate. But his desire to have them stay home and not love, which is one of the things that Aurora's father tells her you should do, you've got to love. So that is a difference between him and Barrett. So at any rate, one, since I just mentioned this question of learning the classics when you're young, let's look at the poem called Development. So this is a poem that Browning wrote the last year, Robert Browning wrote the last year of his life. You could say another poem about the relationship of facts to truth. I think you said that you never read Hard Times, right? No one's read it? famous line in Hard Times is, "Now what I want are facts." And Dickens is, in a way, parodying that demand for facts, that stem-like demand for facts. So this is Robert Browning describing how he learned what he learned and what to think about what it was he thought he learned. So let's just go through it. He is 77 when he's writing this, 76 or 77, and he is thinking back more than 70 years. So why don't we just go around the room? So Eileen, do you want to read, I don't know, just read the first four lines.
Sorry.
It's okay, page 159. Print it out, man. You don't have what?
I don't have any
Lucash. Oh, shoot. Okay. All right, I'll see if I can print it out for you for next class.
Hopefully I should have it by next week.
You should have the book.
Amazon cooperates.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, go Bezos. All right.
Of development?
Yeah.
My father was a scholar and knew Greek. When I was 5 years old, I asked him once, "What do you read about?" "The siege of Troy." "What is a siege and what is Troy?"
Okay, so he's remembering being 5 years old. And what he sees his father doing what?
Reading.
Yeah, you can set the scene. Reading what? Reading in what language?
Greek.
Presumably. So he asks his father, "What do you read about?" And the answer is the siege of Troy. And he asks, "So what is a siege and what is Troy?" So education is beginning. Okay, Sophia, you got a long section to read.
Whereat he piled up chairs and tables for a time, set me atop the Priam. Called our cat Helen, enticed away from home with the said, by wicked parents who purchased them more close. How many?
Yeah, no, sorry, all the way to 23. No, you do great. It's actually really good to read poetry a lot.
Under the footstool being far and late, but him said she was worth the pain's purpose. As I entered, our dogs the
Atreidae
sought by taking Troy to get possession of. Always when great Achilles ceased to sulk, by plenty in the stable, forth with prance and put to flight Hector, our page boy's self. This taught me who was who and what was what. So far, I rightly understood the case. At 5 years old, a huge delight it proved, and still proves, thanks to that instructor sage, my father, who no better than turned straight, Nearing's full flare on weak-eyed ignorance, or worse yet, leave weak eyes to grow sand blind, content with darkness and beauty.
Okay, thank you. That was great. Want to do it again? Oh, well, I didn't think so. Okay, so just quick plot summary. What does his father do?
Kind of set up a real scenario of what the Trojan War was like with household objects and the pets.
Yeah.
Assigned roles, yeah.
Sorry?
Yeah, he assigned various roles to like, so that he could understand it
on right.
a smaller scale.
Yeah, so, you know, it's like doing it with Tinker Toys or Lego. Do you all say Lego?
Lego.
Yeah, no, it's Lego is the correct pronunciation. Just so you know, that's not dialect. Okay, so what story then is he reading? Yeah.
The Iliad?
No.
Iliad.
The Iliad, yeah. Yes. So the Iliad is about the wrath of Achilles, who goes sulking in his tents when he feels that he has been misused by Agamemnon. So that's how the Iliad begins. It's anger, sing, goddess, the anger of Achilles, who got angry when Agamemnon forced him to give up the woman whom he had won in war to Agamemnon himself, when Agamemnon took that woman for himself. So that's the story of the Iliad. So he piled up chairs and tables for a town. What town?
Troy.
Yes. So, whereat he piled up chairs and tables for a town, set me atop for Priam. Who's Priam?
That's So the King of Troy.
The King of Troy. If you've read Hamlet, the speech that the player, or if you've seen Hamlet, the speech that the player recites when Hamlet asks him to speak me a speech is the story of the murder of Priam when Troy falls. But Priam is the King of Troy. He is the father of what two particularly important Trojan figures?
Hector and Paris.
Hector and Paris. And who's Paris? Anyone?
The one who abducts Helen.
The one who abducts Helen and who eventually kills Achilles, although not in the Iliad. But that's what will eventually happen. So Priam is king of Troy. He's got a terrible son, Paris, who's brought all this trouble upon them. And he's got a great son, Hector, who is the one thing standing between them and destruction. And who eventually kills Hector?
Achilles.
So the end of the Iliad, or near the end of the Iliad, is the final confrontation between Achilles and Hector. Achilles kills Hector. The last line of the Iliad is, and so they buried Hector, breaker of horses. So the Iliad begins with Achilles' anger, and it ends with Hector's burial. So that's what his father is reading. Called our cat. What? Who does the cat become?
Helen.
Yeah. Whom Paris has enticed away from home, he said, by wicked Paris, who couched somewhere close under the footstool, being cowardly, but whom, since she was worth the pains, poor puss, Towser and Trey are dogs, the Atreidae sought by taking Troy to get possession of. So the cat is cowardly, not Helen, but the cat is cowardly. So where does the cat hide? This is a very cute story that he's telling. Let the cuteness sink in, to quote Elon Musk. Let that sink in. Do you know what I'm talking about? So when Elon Musk took over Twitter, he went to Twitter headquarters holding a sink that he got from a hardware store. And then he walked in and he said, "Let that sink in," was the caption for the photo that he posted on Twitter. So let that sink in. You get it? It's not really funny.
So
it's so Elon Musk. It's so faux clever. But it's actually a good line for teaching meter, because what we say, the saying is, let that sink in. Trump is running for president again. Let that sink in. Or Trump has accused DeSantis of being a groomer. Let that sink in, right? But if someone wants to bring a sink into a place, you would say, let that sink in. So you know that it means something different based on stress and emphasis. So that's a way of thinking about poetic meter, which occasionally we talk about in this class on poetry. So there's the puss, who is shy, who is cowardly, and who is therefore hiding where?
Under the
footstool, which would be part of the chairs and tables that he's piling up, right? So she is hiding somewhere in Troy, in the Troy that his father has set up, while these two dogs, Towser and Trey, are the Atreidae. People know who they are? House of Atreus? Does that ring a bell? Okay, the House of Atreus is a cursed house, because their father thought it would be a good idea to get revenge on someone by serving him his children for a meal. And so the house gets cursed, and the two Atreidae at this time are Agamemnon and Menelaus. So Agamemnon is going to be murdered by his wife when the Trojan War is over, and the Aeschylus trilogy, the Oresteia, is about how he's murdered by his wife and how his son takes revenge for that murder, for the murder of his father, by killing his mother, which is a harsh thing to harsh revenge and harsh to have to take revenge that way, and then how his son is persecuted by the Furies for the crime of matricide, even though he did it out of a sense of justice for the crime of parricide. He's in an impossible situation. That's what that trilogy is about. So that's where the Trojan War is heading, but it hasn't headed there yet. But just so you know, that's Agamemnon and Menelaus are brothers. They're the house of Atreus, hence they're called the Atreidae. And so here they're the dogs, Towser and Trey. And they sought by taking Troy to get possession of whom?
Helen
or the cat, poor puss. Always, when great Achilles ceased to sulk, my pony in the stable. So Achilles in the Iliad, do people know where he is while the Trojan War is going on and he's refusing to fight because he's sulking?
He's outside in his tent.
Yes, Achilles in his tents. That's the famous phrase. So here it's the pony outside in the stable. That's Achilles. Always when great Achilles ceased to sulk, my pony in the stable, forth would prance and put to flight Hector, our page boy's self. So when the pony finally comes out, when Hector finally comes out and chases Hector and defeats him, that's going to be the pony coming out and chasing and defeating who in this little story? Our page boy's self. So someone who works for them, or possibly he's playing two roles. That is, he's talking about myself. He's both Priam, and now he's going to be Hector when the pony comes out. It's just setting things up. This taught me who is who and what was what. So far, I rightly understood the case at 5 years old. So he gets the story at five. It's like Rick Reardon. A huge delight it proved and still proves. Thanks to that instructor sage, my father, who knew better than to turn straight learning's full flare on weak-eyed ignorance. So what mistake does his father not do?
Try to, like, explain the Iliad to a five-year-old.
Yeah, the way all these Victorian parents do. In particular, John Stuart Mill's father, who taught him Greek, you may know, at the age of three. He was brilliant and amazing, and probably this was not good for him. His biographers think, probably not good personally for him. Or worse, so he didn't turn learning's full flare on weak-eyed ignorance. Or what would be worse, leave those weak eyes to grow sand-blind, content with darkness and vacuity. So his father didn't make two mistakes. Sailed through the Scylla and the Charybdis of two possible mistakes. See what I did there? Mm-hmm. So one mistake would be telling him too much. The other mistake would be what?
Telling him nothing.
Yeah, leave me alone. I'm reading. You don't need to know this. Anyone know the term sand blind? It's kind of interesting that Browning would use it. It's a term that no one really knows what it means from The Merchant of Venice. It seems to mean dazzled or something like that. Browning loved vocabulary and loved words that often whose meanings he didn't know. And one famous example of this, and this is just so Victorian, is that he was reading some book, some anti-clerical book, which used the phrase "a nun's twat," and he didn't know what twat meant, so he thought it was some article of clothing that nuns wore, and he actually put a line in a poem about bishops' croziers and old nuns' twats, and then someone said, not quite these words, "Dude, you can't publish that, you can't print that," and then he found out what the word meant and he changed it. This is an illustration of the way he would grab exotic vocabulary, maybe not quite knowing sometimes what it meant. And sand blind might be an example of that. Sam, can you read the next verse paragraph?
Okay. it happened. 2 or 3 years afterward, that I and classmates playing at Torcy, my father came upon our make believe. How would you like to read yourself the tale properly told, of which I gave you first merely such notion as a boy could bear? Hope now would give you precise account of what someday, by dint of scholarship, you'll hear. Who knows? From Homer's very mouth. Learn Greek by all means. Read The Blind Old Man. Sweetest of Singers. Tuflos, which means blind.
Hedistos.
Hedistos, which means sweetest.
Like hedonic or hedonism. Go on.
Time enough. Try anyhow to master him someday. Until when, take what serves for substitute. Read Pope by all means.
Okay, thank you. Who's Pope?
Alexander Pope.
Why is he saying read Pope? Anyone know?
Well, I mean, he was the poet laureate.
Yeah, but what is the relation to Homer?
He did a translation.
Yeah, so he did, at the time they thought he did a translation of Homer. He translated some Homer and actually farmed out a lot of it. But Pope's translation of the Iliad was one of the standard translations. What was called Pope's translation of the Iliad was one of the standard translations. Cy Twombly, the 20th century very abstract painter, loved Pope's translation of the Iliad as well, so just to mention it. Yes, this is Alexander Pope, maybe most famous now for The Rape of the Lock, or yeah, that's probably right now the poem of his that gets read most, and which is hilarious. Rape there means taking without, it means what it actually means in older English and not what it means now. It means taking without permission. So robbery. And what that's about is someone has a lock of her hair cut off without giving the guy who does it permission to do such a thing. Yeah, read Pope, he says. So again, they love the story. You can tell that little Robert Browning loved the story. He and his playmates are doing it again. And now his father says, read an English translation of the Iliad. Read Pope. And then someday, who might you read in the original? Homer. If you were to learn Greek by all means, read The Blind Old Man. That is Homer, the blind poet. Sweetest of Singers, and then he gives him two Greek words. So someday, time enough, someday, but until then, read Pope. Okay, Samantha. Yeah, just the next verse paragraph.
So I ran through Pope, enjoyed the tale, what is doing so true. Also attacked my primer, generally drudged, and grew bitter thus for what was promised next. The very thing itself, the actual words. When I could turn, say, but then to account.
Okay, so he's reading Pope in English, and what else is he doing?
He's reading a primer?
Yeah, of what language? Of Greek, yeah. So he's trying to learn Greek. He's reading a primer or primer of the Greek language. He's finding it drudging, but he's learning it, grew fitter for what was promised next, the very thing itself. That is Homer in Greek. The actual words, when I could turn, say, Buttmann to account. So Buttmann is a grammar book, a 19th century Greek grammar book, which goes into all the details and when he could use that book to be able to read Greek in the original. Okay, Matt, just the next.
Time passed. I ripened somewhat. One fine day, quite ready for the Iliad, nothing less. That's Hain.
There's Hain.
With the big books block the shelf. Don't skip a word. Thumb well the lexicon.
Yeah, so his father is still teaching him and saying, good, now you can read the Iliad. There is a dictionary. Don't skip any words. Read the whole thing. Make sure you know what every word is. Okay, Arena.
I thumbed well and skipped nosy till I learned.
No wise.
Till I learned who was who, what was what, from Homer's tongue. and they're an end of learning. Had you asked the all-accomplished scholar, 12 years old, who was it wrote the Iliad, what a laugh. Why Homer, all the world knows, of his life, doubtless some facts exist. It's everywhere. We have not settled, though, his place of birth. He begged for certain, and was blind beside, seven cities claimed him. Sicko, with the best right, thinks Byron, what he wrote. Those hymns we have. Then there's the battle of the frogs and mice. That's all. Unless they dig Margites up.
Margites.
Margites up. I like that. Nothing more remains to know.
All right, so he's 12. He's learned his Homer. It's kind of like a Browning bar mitzvah. You read your Homer Pasha, and there's irony here. Had you asked the all accomplished scholar, 12 years old, who was wrote the Iliad, he would know it was Homer, and then he would know there's certain facts that are known about Homer and others that aren't. Some of what they believed in the 19th century is that Homer wrote poems that. Really no one now, or really even back then, people knew that Homer didn't write. The Battle of the Frogs was ascribed to Homer 500 years later, but is not Homer. The Battle of the Frogs and Mice. The Homeric hymns are not Homer. But at the time, there was this sort of mythological Homer who wrote the Iliad, the Odyssey, and these other poems, including the lost thing called the Margites. Quinn, can you do the... Sorry, it's long. The next verse paragraph.
Yeah. Thus did youth spend a comfortable time until... What's this the Germans say, this fact, that Wolf found out first? It's unpleasant work, their chop and change, unsettling one's belief. All the time, while we live, we learn that sure. So I bent brow or... Prolegomena. Prolegomena. And after Wolf, a dozen of his like, proved there never was any Troy at all, neither besiegers nor besieged, nay worse, no actual Homer, no authentic text, no warrant for the fiction I, as fact, had treasured in my heart and soul so long. I mark you, and as fact held still hold, spite of new knowledge in my heart of hearts and soul of souls, fact's essence freed and fixed from accidental fancy's guardian sheath. Assuredly, thenceforward, thank my stars, however it got there, deprive who could, wring from the shrine my precious tenantry, Helen, Ulysses, Hector and his spouse, Achilles and his friend, the wolf, Wolf, why must he needs come doubting, spoil the dream?
Okay, so who do you think Wolf was, and what did he say? It's actually, and in fact, it's Wolf.
Probably a German scholar.
Yes, who?
Homer never existed.
Yeah, Homer never existed. Troy never existed. Yeah. By the way, what turned out to be true in the... What did people discover in the 20th century? That Troy did exist. So 19th century, they were smart. They weren't taken in by these myths. There never was a Troy. But in the 20th century, Schliemann, very famously, who believed in Troy, did some archaeology. And what did he find but Troy? But the 19th century smart, demystified view is none of this stuff ever existed. So he's reading Wolf and his Prolegomena and all these people saying none of this ever existed. And notice, we'll pick up with this on Monday, but notice the metaphor that he's using, which is that he himself is being besieged by these unpoetic scholars. These dry as dust pedants who are saying, no, none of this existed. And so where do these people live? They live in his heart, in my heart of hearts. There, in the shrine of his heart, you can find Helen, Ulysses, Odysseus, Hector and his spouse, Achilles and his friends. So suddenly Wolf becomes like the besieging Greeks. And in Browning's heart, as an adult, the truth of Homer is something that he still sustains. So the story of the Trojan War now becomes the story of defending the story of the Trojan War against the facts, which he knows are facts, or thinks he knows are facts, but nevertheless, he is defending the truth of poetry against the facts of scholarship. And that's a kind of cool thing to do. Okay, well, just read again the last verse paragraph for Monday and have a good weekend. Yeah, well, and bring Thamyris marching in on Monday as well. Okay, have a good weekend, everyone.